Time for another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller. Really pleased to welcome back Melinda Myers of Milwaukee. She hosts the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, hosts Melinda's Garden Moments, and once taught horticulture at Milwaukee Area Technical College. She is the author of several gardening books, including The Wisconsin Lawn Guide, Attaining and Maintaining the Lawn You Want, from Cool Springs Press, and her other books. Oh boy, can't miss Small Space Gardening, Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin, and The Garden Book for Wisconsin, all from Cool Springs Press. Really pleased to welcome her back. If you have some questions about your garden or maybe about your lawn or shrubs, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email at talk@wpr.org. Melinda with us by phone today. Hi, Melinda.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I am doing just great.
Were you able to take advantage of the beautiful weather recently and get out in your garden?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we did some lawn work and we did quite a bit of work in the flower garden and moved a lot of things around.
So your muscles are feeling it. I can hear it over the phone.
Yeah, there was a lot. But I tell you what, it looks pretty nice now. The rains afterward, you know, we got rain just when we needed it, right after planting and replanting, and things look pretty good.
Excellent. I think we're all feeling like spring might actually be here now.
it sure seems like it. You have some podcasts that we should mention right away, I think.
Yeah, I've been trying to cover some. Every week I do a new podcast, and you can check it out on my website. So if you don't have an iPod, and my friends make fun of me because I do podcasts and don't have an iPod, but you can listen to them right on your computer, or you can download them for free onto your iPod if you have one. And I've been trying to hit a variety of topics. The ones that are being added this week or was added this week is really on Gardening 101, and I wanted to just really help people get excited about. I'm talking to a lot of new gardeners and people who have never gardened or maybe have gardened with flowers and not vegetables. And so recently I've been trying to add some things on vegetable gardening, raised beds, containers. If you're brand new to gardening, some things you can do. If you're seasoned a gardener, maybe some ideas to help save you some time and energy in your landscape as well. So they're updated every week. I try to add something new. And if people have topics they want to hear, I'd love to hear from you and add it to the list. We archive the past ones and, as I mentioned, do new ones each week.
And that's at melindamyers.com.
Right, exactly.
M-Y-E-R-S.
Yes. So if you misspell it, we also covered that because I know everybody adds an extra E. So we'll get you there eventually.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You know what? Every one of our lines is filled.
Well, great. Let's get busy.
Yeah, let's go to Susie in Poisipi. Hi, Susie.
Well, good morning on this beautiful spring day.
Oh, isn't it great?
Let's stay out here. I just have two related questions. In doing some of that yard work on those pretty days, I think we have determined that this winter caused the demise of some things.
Okay.
One, a lawn area that we have that is densely shaded by large white pine trees. Because of the watering restrictions, we've had to give up watering in that area as much as we would like, and that really has felt the end of the sod. What we would like to replace it with is a ground cover that can possibly function in those harsh conditions. And my second question, I can take my answers off the air, is in the case of shrubs, we have more than several shrubs that don't seem to be budding out, or a very small part of the shrub budding out. How much of the shrub needs to be budded out in order to make it really worth trying to nurse it back to health, or, you know, when should we just start over?
And don't hang up yet. Do you know what kind of shrubs you have?
Well, we have been having trouble with our little princess and Froboli spirea both.
Okay.
That's one, and we have a Weigelia or Weigela, which
is Weigela, right. That's a weird name.
Right, yeah, it just looks like it's just not going to pop.
Okay. The reason I ask, and we'll start with that, and then, Larry, please help me remember to address the dry shade ground covers. For shrubs, this winter I'm seeing just exactly what you're saying, some mixed results. The good news is, with the spireas, you can cut them back just above ground level, and as long as the roots are okay, they will shoot up new growth. One of the reasons when I prune older spirea, what I like to do in late winter is cut the whole thing back halfway, take half of the stems back to the ground, and then you get new growth from the base sprouting from the old stem, so it's a little bit sturdier. But when I worked for the city of Milwaukee, we had so many that that's really not practical, and every year we cut them back just above ground level. They'll send out new growth. So with those, I wouldn't be concerned. Weigelas, though hardy, I do find that some winters they do really just seem to take a beating. And what you may want to do is, again, kind of look at it. And if a third of the stems are up and redwood, then I would cut back, you know, if you need to adjust any of the height, and you'll get new growth from the base. If they all look dead, I'd cut it back to ground level. Wait until, you know, wait another few weeks. It's still been pretty cool, so it's hard to tell. You know, I would give it a little time to resprout.
Sure.
And then early June, you'll still be plenty of shrubs around, and you can still plant through June, even through the whole summer, as long as you're willing to water.
That's a hopeful message.
That's hopeful message.
That's right. And if you need an excuse to go buy shrubs, just find another spot for those backup plants. You don't want to wait. That's my strategy.
Oh, but think of all the digging you just saved.
Okay,
yeah,
well,
that's
good.
True.
And then you can apply that then to your ground covers. And you have a great question, and I think you're smart. At some point, it's just too shady to grow grass, and in the competition for water, under, you know, heavy canopies, evergreens, and Norway maples and oaks, at some point you're better off just saying, you know what, we're either going to mulch shredded bark if it looks good, just give up growing, or ground covers. And a couple things to try. Dead nettle, lamium, L-A-M-I-U-M, lamium, dead nettle. A lot of different varieties out there, but it takes dry shade. And so when it's done blooming in late spring, early summer, you still have the variegated foliage to brighten up the shade. Coral bells, heuchera, another good one where the foliage is interesting, the flowers are nice. With any of these ground covers, though, the key is going to be water to get them established. So you're still going to need to water, you know, the root system and just beyond to get them established. Once established, they're going to be good drought tolerance. Same with hostas. And, you know, go for the old-fashioned, tough, hardy ones that everybody's digging and dividing. You know, pop some of those in. I love the newer varieties, too. You can also add some of those. And, again, once you get them established, they're going to be good drought-tolerant plants. But add a little bit of extra moisture getting them started, and you'll be amazed at the results that you'll have.
Good luck. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Susie. And Jean in, let's see, where are we going? Sobieski, I believe. Hi, thanks for calling.
That's right. And I would like a little schedule about how to spray my fruit trees. I have apple, pear, plum, and peach. If you could give me just a little, you know.
Ideas.
Right. But, and that's a good question. And one of the things that, and I'm going to give you your schedule, but I'm going to also recommend that you either contact your extension office or go online and download, and it's free, and print out the pest management schedule for those plants, because then you'll have it right there. You can post it by your calendar and refer to it. But one of the things to think about is a lot of us reach for the home orchard spray when we're talking about spraying our fruit trees. The problem with using a home orchard spray is it's got an insecticide and a fungicide. And when we're trying to treat fungal diseases like scab on our apples and pears, and you said you had apples, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is to treat your scab, you really want to start when the buds are swelling, like right now, and showing a bit of color, and you're going to spray throughout the bloom time. But if you use a home orchard spray with an insecticide, you're going to kill the pollinators and you'll eliminate the fruit set. So you want to use a fungicide if apple scab was a problem, you know, at the first sign of the bud swelling every 10 to 14 days, at least 4 to 5 applications. Once petal fall happens, okay, then you can hit it with an insecticide that will take care of many of your different pests. Now the problem then comes with, you know, the weather varies, so timing varies, and the insect populations vary from season to season. So a lot of gardeners will use traps, just kind of fake-looking fruit, and put tanglefoot on to trap the insects so that when you see the adults out there laying their eggs, you know it's time to treat, and you can minimize your pesticide applications. So you may want to do that, you know, hit it at petal fall, and then monitor. There's lots of new things you may want to try. Neem, N as in Nancy, E-E, M as in Mary, as an insecticide. a little bit gentler on the environment and gentler on you if you get any on you, and then you'll have some better results that way. But again, I would recommend if you can get someone to go online or if you have access to the Internet or get to the library and download the University Extension, they have great publications that list out the timing as well.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Jean. And, boy, more callers. Let's go to Walter in Green Bay next. Hi, Walter.
Hi. About a year and a half ago, I had a large weeping willow taken out and the stump ground out. And then last year, I had a landscaper come and smooth out the lawn and put in new sod. And this year, I've noticed that the spot where the large tree was, the grass is dying. Although I had been told by the landscaper that he was going to dig out that area where the tree was and replace it with new soil. Anyway, I'm wondering what can I do about this dead spot in the middle of my lawn?
I'm sorry you have the problem, but I'm glad you asked the question because it's a very common problem. Even if you do replace the soil, it's so hard to get all of that debris out of there. And the part, when we grind out stumps, that part of the tree is designed to be underground, so it takes a long time for it to decompose. And what happens is the micronutrients or microorganisms working on breaking it down temporarily tie up the nitrogen in the soil. When they're done, they'll release that and more back into the soil, but we often are starving our grass. And what you may want to do is use a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer, something like a Milorganite, so that you're not, you don't want to overdo it and burn the lawn, but by using a slow release, you're feeding the microorganisms. So if you're going to overseed or reseed or resod that area, if it's dead, you know, what you may want to do is add a little bit of that into the soil before you plant and then just kind of monitor it and see that, you know, that may be an area you need to just do a little extra fertilizing the first couple of years until all of that, all those stump grindings are out of there. It's just very difficult, like I said, even if they removed it and added more, there's just so much going on in that soil below that it often takes a while. I know some people have created gardens just because they couldn't deal with the problem anymore and went, created a garden until that was all gone and then overseeded it, but it may not look good in your landscape plan, so maybe consider trying a little bit of fertilizer, but go with a low nitrogen slow release so you don't end up damaging and burning those young grass plants.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
And good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Melinda Myers, our guest today as we talk all things in the lawn and in the garden on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking all things in the garden with Melinda Myers. Thanks for listening in. If you have a question, give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And Jane in Madison up next. Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about my daylilies that they're coming up nicely now, nice and green, but then the leaves start turning yellowish, and I don't know. I don't know if it's a fungus or not, but I'm wondering what I can do about it.
You might want to take a sample to the extension office. We've had some problems with daylily rust, which is a problem because it's a hard one to eradicate from the garden. Removing and destroying those infected plants, some fungicide sprays can be helpful. And the reason I just mention it is we're really trying to contain it so it doesn't become a major problem in the state because we've had a few problems with it around the state. So you might want to either send it to the diagnostic lab if that sounds like a problem. If it just seems to be a general decline, you know, you might want to check, is the drainage good? Is that a problem? I hate to recommend a fungicide without really taking a look at it, and because of the concern with rust, if you can get a sample into the extension office, call first and find out their policy of dropping off samples. That might be a good one, or sending a sample into the plant diagnostic lab because they can take a look at it and really confirm before I tell you to go out and spray or tell you how to dig and get rid of them. You know, if they're plants that you don't aren't attached to and it's been a continual problem, you might want to just dig those up, get rid of them. Most municipalities let you throw small quantities away, and then put something else in that area, not a daylily, in case it is a disease, and then get some fresh, new, clean, healthy daylilies and start a new garden of daylilies, you know, a new patch somewhere else in the garden. But I'd really like you to get it diagnosed before I say, oh, I'll spray this, it'll be fine, because it may not be that problem. The other issue is sometimes we have damage from rodents. Voles love the roots, the fleshy roots of daylilies, and often coming out of winter, they've done some damage on hostas and daylilies, and you may want to dig around and make sure that there's not been root damage that's weakening the plants and causing the yellowing. If that is the case, you might want to dig, divide, clean up that plant, and reset them, and that may be enough to kind of invigorate them and get them up and growing again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I can't really, I don't have these symptoms until they're much, you know, more mature.
Okay, then it is it might be a disease problem. So then what I would say is you may want to, you may decide that, well, let's grow it and see how it progresses this year, and then take a sample into the extension office at that time. You can also email, and I appreciate people who are patient with me. We've tried to get the database up and running to reduce the number of questions. Not that I'm not happy to answer them, but so that I get back to you. But I would start with extension, the Plant Diagnostic Lab. You could send a digital picture to my website, too, and we can take a look at it. But I'll tell you, Brian Huddleston's the Dr.
Right.
Death, as we call, he likes to be called, and he's the pro.
Where is that in Madison?
If you, and Larry, I'm going to you. On
yeah,
this one.
just stay listening. I'll give you the exact address of the plant disease clinic in just a minute. It'll just take me a minute to look it up.
Okay,
it's in Russell Lab, I think.
Yeah, it's in Russell Lab, but I'll give you the exact address.
Thanks, Larry.
I can find it, Russell Lab. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll look it up anyway.
Okay, thanks, Larry. I appreciate it. I should just call it up on mine. But, Brian, I just want to put a plug in. We have, between Phil Pelletier and Brian Huddleston, just a great resource with extension in terms of diagnosing insect and disease problems. You know, I think the agents do a great job. It varies from county to county. It's always easier if you can see the problem. Over the phone, some things are easy to diagnose, but when we get into things that we're worried about, like the daylily rust, it's always a good idea to have those checked out. Or there are a few diseases that we're just trying to monitor, insects that, you know, we're worried about their spread throughout the state. So that's a good resource to use for those, especially for those things.
Absolutely.
And I know Brian was on not too long ago,
yep.
I think.
Yeah, and he'll be on again.
Yes, exactly.
But in the meantime, I'll look up that address.
Okay, great.
Let's go to Rick in South Range. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
My pleasure. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
We have a problem with strawberries. We've grown them for years up here. South Range is about 8 miles south of Superior. But in 2007, we decided to start all over because, as I've been told, strawberries are their own worst weed.
That's a good description, yes.
And my wife was seeing a lot of wild strawberries mixed in, and it was just too much work, so we completely took them all out, rototilled them out, and pulled out all the plants, and bought new plants from Jung's, and they sprouted, they greened up, they started to flower, and by the end of June, they were all dead. And we were most disappointed, so we called them up, and they didn't have any at the time, but they said, we'll send you some more, and we got them in August, and we replanted, and they did the same thing. They greened up and looked just fine, all 24 plants, and they all died in September. Now, last year, in 08, we left that part of the garden fallow, and we're concerned about, should we try it again in that same location, or do you think?
When you got rid of your other planting, did you spray the area with anything?
No, we took them out all mechanically.
Okay, so you didn't use a weed killer of any sort?
No.
You know, anytime you lose a planting two times in a row, my philosophy is always, it's time to move
on. Time to move on.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, that's just so, you know, when you hear that, you think of some kind of toxin in the soil, but it sounds like you didn't apply anything and things were growing fine before.
Yes.
You know, I would probably leave that area fallow for a couple of years or plant something unrelated to strawberries, which are in the rose family, and I would plant something unrelated if you could. You may want to try, tomatoes are very sensitive to anything, you know, you may want to throw a few tomatoes or something quick growing to see if they die also. And then at that point, the problem is checking for any kind of toxins. Does a gas line go through there? Or
no.
Okay. And there's...
My wife did put a... Well, everybody who has irises knows you have too many irises at some point in time. So she put a whole bunch of irises in there last year, and they grew just wonderfully.
Okay, then it sounds like you must have a virus or some kind of disease in the soil, a soil-borne disease that obviously strawberries are susceptible to.
Okay.
And you're right, your gut reaction is right, we need to move it. What happens and why farmers rotate crops and gardeners to some extent do it is if you have a planting in there, the same type of plants year after year after year, disease and insects can build up and wipe out the plant. So it may be that there was something in there, either the wild strawberries in the soil, and because they're new plants, they're more easily affected and damaged. So, yeah, I think maybe making that into the iris garden and starting a strawberry patch somewhere else might be your best bet.
Well, thanks for the advice.
I wish I had that. I wish I could tell you it's a done deal, but unfortunately, no.
And thanks a lot for calling. I did go online and take a look, and the Plant Disease Clinic, one of the things I note is that there are six or seven different types of plants that you might send in or pieces of plants, and how you send them in is important.
Right.
So it might be wise, I just typed in UW Plant Disease Clinic, and it popped up. And you might just go to that, and there's specific instructions about mailing a sample if you're in Wisconsin or if you're not in Wisconsin. There's a couple different ways to do it. So,
thank you for bringing that up, Larry, because there's nothing worse. And they usually recommend mailing on a Monday so that it doesn't sit in the post office all weekend deteriorating also, because they can only diagnose as good as the sample is.
And Brian's back on May 29th.
Okay, great.
All right, let's take some more calls. And on to Paul in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Paul.
Hi, and thank you so much. I need some help. I have a couple of questions, but let me preface by saying that I do large container gardens here in Duluth, and I live really close, about 300 yards from Lake Superior, so it's a little cooler here.
I was lucky enough to speak in Duluth, I think it was late May or June, and it gave me a good appreciation for tough northern gardeners.
They call
let me
it
tell
cooler
you.
By the lake for a reason in the summertime. I was fortunate enough to get some seeds from Jim Nienhausen of his Wisconsin roaster chilies.
Oh, his Wisconsin Rosta.
Rosta.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
He's still looking for a name for it, I guess. I guess we could call him Rasta. But I don't know. Anyway, I started all of my chilies. I got only 12 seeds from him, and 10 of them have sprouted in my indoor trays, which I consider a pretty good success
right.
rate. And I also have three other varieties that I ordered. Now, yesterday, we had a beautiful southern breeze, and it got up to about 75 on my deck. And it was sunny, and I put them outside with the cover off of the,
Oh, the propagator, okay.
Yeah, and now I'm wondering, they're about an inch tall, all of them are. What do I do from here on out? I don't get very good sunlight in my house. And I'm just afraid they're going to croak before I can get them in the garden.
One of the things I like to do and is if you have a nice sheltered place, you know, with all our transplants we start indoors, or if you buy them right in the greenhouse, you need to harden them off anyway, is gradually introducing them into brighter sunlight and get them toughened up. One of the things I like to do is I use a product called Remay, or sold as Harvest Guard, Remay, or Grass Fast, the white type of Grass Fast. And it's a polypropylene spun fabric, and it lets air, light, and water through but traps heat around the plants. Or if you have a cold frame, that's even better. But what I find with this is when I'm bringing my plants out, I pop them in there, cover them up so it protects them. It's nice and warm and toasty, but they tend not to overheat like in a plastic covered greenhouse or a cold frame where you need to vent, but it protects them from cooler temperatures, protects them a bit from the wind, And it does let light through, but I find it helps make that transition period less work for me. So I think you may, and especially, I know some gardeners have put their plants in wagons and they wheel them out on the nice days, wheel them in the garage on the cold days. So it's easier to move them or put them in a kid's sled and pull them in and out. I think, you know, if you're willing to do the work of taking them out on the nice days and giving them a little added protection, you know, a little bit of shade, gradually increase the sunlight, and then trying that Remay, I think that might be a good way to transition them outside, take advantage of the better sunlight outdoor, but yet protect them from the harsh climate that, you know, it's still early May that we're all going to get, and probably more likely you than me.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing. I have, I've started some cantaloupe seeds,
mm-hmm.
and now when I order these things, I try to make sure I get things that will grow within the
short,
you know,
season.
Growing season for
right.
my area. And I planted these again in my seed starter kit, and they didn't even sprout. And I'm wondering if I could just go ahead. I've got my soil prepared and everything is ready to rock and roll outside. Could I just go ahead and seed those directly, do you think?
Yeah, and these are in containers, right?
Well, not the melons.
Okay. One of the problems is the cool soil as well, so that's one I definitely cover with the Remay. You may even want to cover the garden with plastic and warm the soil up for a cup of clear plastic or dark plastic to warm the soil up. Clear plastic will warm it faster for a week or so. Plant your seeds, then cover it with Remay. That would be good, or the floating row covers. In the pots, I forgot to mention a product called Wall of Water or Aqua Dome that you could put your peppers right in the containers if that's where you're growing them, or in the garden and use the Remay too. But if you're going to plant in ground, warm up the soil for a week, maybe two, lightly cultivate to remove any weeds. You don't want to dig up more. And then pop in your plants and cover them with the Remay. And that would be a great way to get an early start. Farmers in Vermont did this on acres and acres, and they were able to harvest tomatoes at the time they'd usually just be setting blossom by using these floating row covers.
Oh, man. Well, good luck.
And you'll make all your neighbors jealous when
yeah.
you're harvesting.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary Ellen in Milwaukee, we go to you now. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, Mary Ellen.
My question is about the zoysia grass that you see advertised in the paper once in a while. It is so tempting because since I care for the lawn now, I refuse to fertilize and pesticide and all of that kind of stuff.
Don't
and
do
the leaves
it.
Are taking over.
Don't do it.
Larry's right. Don't do it. And I know those ads are so tempting. And if you heard me chuckling, it wasn't at you. It was like, okay, it's that zoysia grass time. And because you're right, the ads make it sound great. Here's the problem and why Larry's screaming, don't do it. It's a southern grass, and so it does great in hot, dry weather. But you think about Wisconsin, and so it's brown. I drive around and I see the people in my neighborhood who have fallen for the ads because their lawns are still nice and brown when mine's green. And so you only get a green lawn for a few times. It's a southern grass, and they used to say, well, it's not reliably hardy. Well, it may not, but if it survives, it is hard to get rid of. It's thick, it's dense, it's brown most of the year because of the cooler temperatures here, and only green for a couple of months. So you're going to have an ugly-looking lawn. So Larry's right, don't do it. What you may want to do, you know, and the things I talk about in my lawn book is I talk about getting the subtitle is Attaining and Maintaining the Lawn You Want, is we all have different expectations for our lawn. You know, some people want golf course quality, and they're going to have to put that kind of work in. Some people just want their grass green to keep their feet from getting muddy and their neighbors from complaining. And what you can do is mow high, mow often as you can, you know, so you're only removing about an inch at a time. Leave those clippings on the lawn. That's one fertilization. And for me, I keep thinking if it's a double the benefit, I'm cutting the grass and I'm fertilizing and adding organic matter. If you only fertilize once, and I think it was the University of Wisconsin found, you can greatly reduce your weeds by just fertilizing once. And I would do it like around Halloween.
Yep.
And then you're going to be amazed at the difference that one fertilization makes. And then, you know, you're not going to have golf course quality grass, but you're going to have a good enough lawn that your neighbors will be happy, and I think you'll be happy, and you can minimize your workload. If the weeds become a problem and you don't want to use traditional chemicals, corn gluten meal was found by the Iowa State University to be effective at preventing seed germination. Two applications, 3 years in a row, they found that you could really greatly reduce your weeds. So, you know, if the one fertilization isn't giving you the results, then you may want to do a spring and a fall application of the corn gluten meal, you know, 3 years in a row to reduce that weed population. So there are things you can do to step it down and keep the lawn looking good. Let it go dormant during drought. The weeds will come back better than your lawn, but your lawn will recover.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So hang in there.
Hang in there. And thanks a lot, Mary Ellen, for calling. Diane in Mishicot, on to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi there. I really appreciate your taking my call. I had part of my question answered in from a previous caller's question, but I was wondering, I know that you're not supposed to plant any kind of a crop in successive years in the same spot, but I was wondering, I needed just a small amount of space to plant tomatoes again. And I was wondering if I took all the dirt out that I had planted in last year and replaced it with different dirt, if that would be good enough.
Well, did you have problems with your tomatoes last year?
No, not really.
Okay. You know, I have a small, my vegetable garden, I mix my vegetables in with my flowers, but my dedicated vegetable garden is about 3 feet wide and the length of my garage. That's because I have a small space. My rotating of tomatoes is one end of the garden to the other, which, you know, and then I grow peppers and eggplants, and they're all related. So the thing I would recommend doing is using organic matter to amend your soil. And I was just meeting with a gentleman who has a product called Purple Cow, and it's not manure. It's a compost product. And he was telling me they had done some research, and the University of Wisconsin is looking at it, as well as somebody in Hong Kong and South Africa, a tomato grower in South Africa, applied this, they made a tea out of it, but you could use the Purple Cow organic matter. They applied it to the soil in a field that had tomato blight, and they typically would let it go fallow for a couple years. But they applied this, they planted, and they found that using this Purple Cow, and part of it, they made a tea out of it and sprayed it on the, you know, the plants when they fertilize, but by using this, that the microorganisms help to fight some of the fungal disease. Now, since you haven't had disease problems, adding organic matter, and you might want to check out this activated compost, really often is enough to keep your plants healthy. Work on that soil biology, proper spacing, and I know that's the hardest problem I have, proper spacing, and if you haven't had problems, I wouldn't replace the soil. You might end up with a bigger problem of weeds or something else. If you do need to rotate out because you do have problems, you may want to rotate out into containers a year or two if you do develop problems, and then back in your garden after that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that sounds
that makes sense.
Very reasonable.
Yeah.
I had a comment to make that I didn't tell your screener about, but I used to get Organic Gardening Magazine, and one of the hints in there, one of the tips was to get river water if the river water was safe in your area. And I live very near a river, so I take a walk down and I have my bucket and I throw over the guard there and pull the river water. And I water everything that I can with it. I have strawberries, and then I'm going to have the tomato plants. And I even use it on my house plants. And you would not believe how they perk up. And it might have something to do with living near farmland and river water, river runoff, you know, from the fertilizer from the farms. And I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but I know frog stuff, you know, fish have to do their job. And
exactly. So getting a little free fertilizer. And I think you brought up a good point. You want to make sure your water's safe because, you know, part of what happens with water treatment is to take care of any things that are being placed in the river that aren't safe. So you bring up a good point. But I think it's like capturing rainwater in your rain barrel. You know, it's not treated. It's right from the sky. So we don't have some of those fluoride and chlorine, which we need to make our water safe to drink. But and plants can tolerate it, but you're right. I think you see when you capture rainwater, too, that difference in the health and vigor of your plants.
Absolutely. Thanks, Diane, for calling. Appreciate your call. Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Yes, good morning. As soon as our crabapple tree finishes blooming, we have to do a severe pruning of that crabapple. And by that, I mean removing most of two major limbs. I'm wondering what precautions we should bear in mind when we do that.
Try to prune during a dry period. I'm guessing there's a utility line or something that you're trying to...
That's the essence of it. Mainly, though, it's shading of our porch where we're going to grow things in containers.
Okay. One thing you might want to consider is, and then I'll give you advice, too, is looking for a certified arborist that might be able to help you thin out the crown versus removing the major branches so you can increase the light. That's why I was asking why you need to increase mm-hmm. the light but still maintain kind of the form and the look of the plant. The main thing with pruning during the growing season with crab apples, pears, and anything susceptible to fire blight is to try to prune during dry periods. Now, I know we can't always predict, but you may want to look for the weather forecast and see if we're entering a dry period. That would be one thing to consider. Disinfect your tools if you suspect any fire blight. And fire blight's a disease that really wiped out pear production in Wisconsin years ago, but it's a bacteria that enters the tree through wounds, bees, other things, and especially during wet weather. And it causes the tip of the branch to turn black, like it's been burned, and curl.
Right.
Okay, so you know fire blight.
Yeah.
Okay, so disinfecting your tools with a 1-part bleach, 9-part water solution, you know, just dipping it between cuts if you suspect fire blight, those would be the things that I would recommend you do to minimize the risk of, for me, that would be the biggest risk.
Sure.
And then trying to prune selectively so you maintain the overall shape, too.
Yet the limbs have to go. And
okay.
One other point about it, that eventually we want to get, it's so gigantic, we want to get it down to what's sometimes called orchard shape.
Right. And that's where reducing the crown height, and often what will be done is you're taking those big branches down to side branches. So you're right. It looks more like those orchard trees that are all about production and not necessarily beauty. And so bringing those down to size to side branches that are at a height that you're going to be able to maintain the plant. If you can do it gradually, it sounds like you've already done a lot of research on this. If you can do it gradually over time, two benefits. One, less stressful on the tree, but two, less regrowth. Because anytime you prune severely, you get a lot of regrowth, a lot of suckers forming, as you probably know. And so you're going to have a lot more pruning. So the more gradual you do this, the less work for you in the long run.
And good luck. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Melinda Myers, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, and she's the author of many books, including Can't Miss Small Space Gardening, Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin, and The Garden Book for Wisconsin, all from Cool Springs Press. You can find out about all of her books and her podcasts at her website, melindamyers.com. And if you want to ask her a question right now, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. And Norma in Manitowoc has called us, so let's go to Norma. Hi, Norma.
Hi, Larry. Melinda, I use your garden book all the time as a reference.
Oh, thank you.
I've got two quick questions. I moved in 4 years ago, and there are some viburnums that look like they're in pretty poor soil, dry shade, and the leaves are yellowish, the veins are darker, and I was told by someone that they need something that sounded like a copper additive to the soil.
Okay, a couple things you might want to check. They may have said like a chelated iron, maybe. Does that sound?
That's what I saw.
Or manganese. Okay.
But no, what would you recommend? They are sort of stunted. They've never bloomed.
A couple things I would look for. First, I'd make sure that you don't have a problem with viburnum borer. We're seeing problems with viburnum borer on Korean spice viburnum, lantana, wayfaring viburnum, The American and European cranberry bush viburnum, the native arrowwood viburnum seems to be resistant. And what happens is this insect lays its eggs at the base of the plant, the eggs hatch, and these borer worm-like insects feed inside. Often it causes the leaves to be chlorotic, like you're seeing, wilt. Sometimes you can just pull that stem after the damage is really bad and just remove it. So check at the base if you would see any sawdust-like fresh.
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay, that's good.
It looks like poor nutrition.
Okay, that's good. What I would recommend doing is you might want to try using an organic mulch if you haven't already, shredded leaves or shredded
mm-hmm.
bark or wood chips.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to try using, and the one reason I'm recommending Milorganite is it does have 4% iron, and it's in a plant-available form, and you might try that. It's
mm-hmm.
a low-nitrogen, slow-release fertilizer, so you can put it down and see if that greens it up. You may also want to then look for chelated iron or manganese. Copper is a micronutrient that's used in such small quantities
mm-hmm.
by the plant that, boy, it's really easy to overdo it and damage it. And we typically don't see copper deficiencies. It's more iron or manganese.
Okay.
And so you might want to start with, like, the Milorganite. If that doesn't work, try to get a chelated iron or manganese. There are different products with different names, and I'm not sure if Greenol is still on the market. The Mir Acid might be one that you could try. And if it doesn't seem to start greening it up, then you may be looking at trying a foliar application short-term to see, is it a micronutrient deficiency? The Mirac,
okay.
I think, has a foliar formulation. Try spraying the leaves, and if it greens it up, but the soil additive doesn't, there might also be a problem with root damage or stem damage
mm-hmm.
that's preventing the nutrient uptake. But, you know, I would start there with, you know, hit it with the Milorganite because of the iron and do an organic mulch. Watch the moisture. You know, moisture
uh-huh.
deficiency prevents the plants from uptaking the nutrients. So it might be one of those that just beefing up your watering a bit more,
okay.
you know, during, especially if it's an area under overhang or it doesn't get a lot of rain. A good soaking, you know, every few weeks if we don't get a rain might
mm-hmm.
be also enough to take care of it.
All right.
Wonderful. And then I have dug a lot of sod and put in a lot of shrubbery beds. I'm wondering if I can expand my beds by laying down newspaper. Will that kill the grass after a while, and how long?
You know what? I'd love to do that method. And one of the things I'll do is edge the bed to disconnect the grass, cut the grass really short to
uh-huh.
speed up its decline, throw newspaper, like you said, several layers, and then wood chips on top.
Uh-huh.
And then that just holds the newspaper in place. The newspaper gradually decomposes. You could plant right away, you know, and pop
mm-hmm.
in the shrubs, but it's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
So my philosophy is, because I'm kind of lazy, low input, is I like to do it either like in the spring and then by fall, which is a great time to plant, late summer, early fall, put my shrubs in. And then the grass is pretty well dead. It's easier to dig up. Or do it in the fall and plant in the spring, and that way, you know, it makes my job easier, and you've taken care of the grass without any chemicals, killing the grass without chemicals.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. Thank you.
You
All
bet.
Right.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling, Norma. Appreciate it. And Brent in Maquonigo, you are up. Thank you for calling.
No problem. Yes, I'm calling in response to the lady, maybe about 10 minutes ago, who was trying to get her lawn real thick and rich, but she had weeds. And the technique that I use and have been using for 15 years is real simple. If she simply mows her yard so that the grass length is 4.5 inches, it won't look like a golf course, but if she does this for 2 years, the longer grass, the 4.5-inch tall grass in the lawn chokes out every kind of weed you can imagine. I had thistles the size of a football. I had clover, a field of clover in the middle of my lawn for whatever reason. It chokes out everything. And also, for the first 2 years that you do this, you don't do any fertilizing. And it will. I guarantee it. I learned it from a friend of mine who grows herbs for a living. And part of his living, anyway. And I went over and looked at his lawn, and I couldn't believe it. And it was just beautiful. And it's thick and rich, and the grass blades were strong.
Good recommendation. Taller grass, you have a deeper root system, more drought tolerant. They're the last ones to go dormant during a dry period. More, like you said, crowd out the weeds very effectively. And it's one of those things, I have to tell you a funny story. I live in the city, and, you know, when I bought the house, raised the mowing height to keep it high, and my neighbors kept thinking I was too busy to cut my grass and kept helping me by mowing it. And how do you say, thank you, but please keep your mower off my lawn? So I appreciate that. That's great. Good keeping it tall. If you can't do 4.5, 3.5 is definitely, and I appreciate 4.5 is great. And if you have the lawn person that likes it shorter, you may have to gradually trick them into not noticing and gradually raising that mowing height over time if they're not willing to make the leap right away. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, it's one of the best things you can do for your lawn.
Easiest and very effective.
Thanks, Brent. Appreciate it. And let's go to Yvonne in Brown Deer. Hi, Yvonne.
Hello, Melinda.
Hey, Yvonne. Well, it's a good thing I'm on public radio because it makes sure we get to chat at least a couple times a year. How are you doing?
Well, I'm stumbling along as usual in the spring, although it's been a fantastic spring.
Yeah, it is, and it's good to see the sunshine.
Oh, God, yes. I have three things I want to talk about, compost, tomatoes, and blood meal.
Okay.
Okay.
Blood meal, I read in a book that you can use a fistful of that to a bushel of your brown materials for the compost.
Okay.
And or can use it as a substitute for compost.
I'll tell you that this
is a book from 1954. Not your years, I know. from the National Plant Food Institute.
Interesting. My only concern would be using it as a substitute for compost. I think compost does some different things than organic fertilizer. So.
Yeah.
It's an organic source of nitrogen, blood meal. A lot of people use it to repel animals. it's one of those things that it's you'd have to haul in a lot and spend a lot of money to overdo it.
Would you ever?
It could make it safe. So that's interesting. I'm a big fan of compost for several reasons. We have all this organic stuff we need to compost and get rid of, and it's better to get rid of it by making it into compost and using it in our yard. So that's interesting, though.
Okay, two other things now. The tomatoes. My tomato seedlings have stopped growing recently.
Hmm.
And I'm hoping they're not totally stunted.
They're inside?
Well, they've been in and out. At night and out in the daytime.
Have you, and I, are they, I'm assuming they're in a seed starting mix or a soilless mix?
So I'm thinking of adding, some kind of fertilizer to it.
Yeah. What
I had some blood meal in it before.
Yeah. Well,
not
and
blood
I think
meal. I had the other meal.
Okay, the bone meal?
Bone meal.
Yes.
Yeah, bone meal is a source of phosphorus, very slow release. And I kind of chuckle when I was talking to Art Van Zanten, who owns Holland Beauty Bulbs, and we were talking about bone meal and the use of it. It was Brett and Becky's bulbs talking about, you know, well, bone meal is a great way to bring rodents into the garden when you fertilize your bulbs. Like, here, not only will you eat the bulbs, but you got some bone meal to bring in.
Mm.
What I'd probably do is either use Loretta Hernday, who got me started on worm composting, used to use worm castings on her transplants, a low nitrogen, really fortified with lots of good things. That might, if you have access to worm compost, that might be a nice way. The blood meal would be a good way, or a dilute solution of a more traditional fertilizer if that's available. But that might be a little bit of a gentle way of nudging them into growth.
Okay, on potatoes, I'm mentioning that because in this, I don't know which book of, I've got a library of garden books, you
right.
know, like you do too, and somewhere along there, I learned there was a whole big article on potatoes, and one of the things they mentioned was that if you have problems with diseases in your soil,
mm-hmm.
if you grow potatoes for several years, it cleans it up,
mm.
which
mm.
I thought was extremely interesting for that particular plant.
Yeah, because, boy, when you think about growing potatoes, but they're growing them in field, the same field year after year.
Yeah.
They do have problems with blight, and you look at the things with Ireland. So, interesting. Yeah. One of the things that I always in reading, and I know you're really good at this, but for others listening, is look at the source. Look at the research base, and that's my years in extension, can you tell? And I know you spent some time working the phones to find out where it's coming from. And the day now with the internet, boy, there's a lot of stuff out there that the website looks good, but I worry about where the information's coming from. So it'd be worth following up on. I've never seen that. Might be a good question to ask Brian. I'm going to put him on the spot.
And he's on the 29th
That's
of May,
right.
For
How
sure.
about that? We've already sent two callers to him.
Thanks a lot for...
Don, always good to hear from
you. Thanks a lot for
you
calling.
Take care.
Appreciate your call. Melinda Myers, our guest. By the way, take a look at her website, www.melindamyers.com. It's a great, she's got lots of great information on there, and you're also able to sign up for her podcasts and find out about how you can get copies of all of her books. Melinda Myers, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. I tell you what, she does a wonderful job. She has several books out, The Wisconsin Lawn Guide, Attaining and Maintaining the Lawn You Want from Cool Springs Press, among many. And at our website, melindamyers.com, you can find out more about that. But I know we have questions about handling out-of-zone plants. We've got grapes and rootstock questions. We've got a strawberry bed question. We have onions in the question mill here already. What about you? If you have a question, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. We'll be back with Melinda right after this look at the news. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with today my guest Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener, author of many gardening and lawn books. Take a look at her website at melindamyers.com for all the great information that she has there. And if you have a question for her right now, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And, boy, Karen in Portage has been waiting a while, so let's go right to Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Yes, my plants are growing while I wait.
Well, at least you're not wasting time, right?
I am a frustrated jungle gardener. I look in the catalogs, and I go, oh, look at that, zone 5, zone 6. Now, I have some things that are the higher zones, as in begonia tubers, which you rest in the winter, and angel trumpet, which I put into kind of a dormancy state in a semi-dark room. But now I have a pink mooly or mully grass I couldn't resist.
Oh, yeah.
It's zone...
Is it like a 7 or 8, maybe?
I think it's zone 6.
Okay.
And some other ones that are like zone 5, zone 6. And I'm assuming anything higher, you would have to keep it in the house during the winter in an attempt to keep it in a live growing state. But I'm wondering, like on that grass and that, if I am better off to leave it get frosted, go into dormancy, and then attempt to keep it at a just below freezing temperature, or if I'm better off to bring it in before or after frost, keep it semi-dormant, or keep it growing.
Well, I've seen molly grass growing in Florida, so it's in areas where... It doesn't go dormant because it doesn't get those freezing temperatures. But that's hard to achieve that state. It sounds like you have a pretty good knack at keeping, of dealing with your zone envy that we all have and keeping those plants alive. It may be worth trying if you've got a cool room where you could keep it with sunlight and then just water as needed. So you're not promoting active growth. You're keeping it alive, but not growing. Maybe something similar to the angel's trumpet would be my next choice to try. I know some people who've kept fountain grass alive, the types that aren't hardy here, in a cool situation, like under the benches of a cool greenhouse or in the basement as a somewhat, you know, keeping it cool like you do your geraniums, letting them go dormant and then trying to bring them back. But that's always hard for us to achieve because a lot of us don't have the cool, non-freezing temperatures where they'd survive. So my thought would be if you could run them like your angel's trumpet or grow them like a plant would be my first two choices. Honestly, I haven't talked to anybody who's overwintered them up here. And as I mentioned, I've seen them growing in Florida, you know, where they don't get typically the freezing temperature. So yeah. That's why I'm thinking if you could keep it alive in a cool, brightly lit area, just watering as needed, a little on the sparse side, you might be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll have to let me know how that works for you so we can pass it on to others.
Give it a shot. You like to live dangerously, don't you, Karen? Thank you very much for calling. Oh, there's a lot more work connected with when you try to push the envelope.
I know, and I think once you're hooked on gardening, it seems like a disease we all have. Well, I'm just going to try this one, and then it's two and three, four plants you end up bringing inside for winter.
Let's go to Jill in Milwaukee next. Hi, Jill. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having this great program, and I just want to say that I really enjoy watching your television programs, Melinda, and reading your articles in the Milwaukee Journal.
Thank you.
I live in River West. I'm a renter, and I'm kind of restoring an old abandoned garden that is underneath. I think they try to put a lawn on it, and but the mud is absolutely wonderful. And every year I add about 6 feet to it until I eventually will have it all back. It's got a fence on one side of it that has some grapes that they put out the blossoms, but apparently they weren't pollinated, so we had no fruit on it last year. And I didn't cut it back this year, and I'm wondering whether I should have or whether it's too late to do that.
Yeah, it's a little late to be doing pruning. You may want to just at least shorten up the plant a bit. We usually like to do them when they're dormant. And pruning is, believe it or not, one of the best things to do to promote fruiting.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So by and grapes are not for the lighthearted. It's for the people that like to get out the pruners and really do some cuts. Because, boy, you're really cutting that huge plant back down to size.
I cut it back to just about the bowl last year.
The key is like and I don't know if you're using the double knifing system where you've got the four branches or an umbrella system, but you have your main stem and your side shoots, and then you're going to be training off of that the fruiting canes off of that. So you do need some length left so that you get the spurs that develop into the fruiting canes.
Okay.
So you may have been, so that was a year ago you pruned heavy and didn't get fruit?
It got the
flowers,
but they didn't get pollinated, I don't think.
Yeah, well, it could be, you're right. Was there bee activity? Was there
crazy? I don't
think
so. I think we have a problem. I understand that we're supposed to be able to keep bees in the city. That's something that I read is a possibility of coming up.
Well, and I know there's a big activity going with Extension has a beekeeping program.
Yeah.
And you might check with the Milwaukee County University Extension. It's a beekeeping, I think they're even doing a training and certification program.
Oh, good. That sounds wonderful.
So, and that would be great. And then also planting things like borage and other flowers that bring
them
in.
Borage takes over. I'm just trying to pull borage out of there. Because it's just all over the place. I'm
sorry to laugh. I should comfrey was worse for my house, so the borage looked tame compared to the comfrey I had to get rid of. So
I'm also trying to get some raspberries in there, and I have gotten a wooden arbor that I thought maybe would help contain the grapes if I can convince
them
to move over there.
Yeah. I think that's a great idea, and I think, grapes are a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
But, boy, once you get them going.
Well, they're taking all the sun from the rest of the plant, growing along the fence, and that's one of my concerns about it. There's also a mulberry that's kind of growing in the middle of the fence.
Okay.
You know, it's half on one side and half on the other. It's a wire fence.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't know that it's salvageable. I started to dig it out, but my neighbor on the other side wants it.
Oh.
And I was thinking that we might do better to just get a new one and let this poor sad thing, you know.
And especially if it's growing through the fence.
Yeah.
And then mulberries are wonderful. The park across the street from me has a mulberry or several, and so we all have mulberries we're weeding out of our yards right across the street. So it's one of those things deciding, too, because they're big trees. And,
yeah, they are.
And kind of big for, you know, some of the smaller lots I know that are in River West.
Yeah.
And also, like you said, sometimes we have to make choices in small lots. You know, mulberry would be nice, but maybe there are better choices for a small lot to give you either the shade or the food that you want to eat. So,
okay.
And thanks for being a renter that cares enough to plant and make their landscape beautiful.
Great. I have one last question, which is about rain barrels.
Mm-hmm.
Last year I just put out a bunch of Rubbermaid-type containers.
Right.
And captured water in that because I was afraid that anything coming off of the roof would have the little shingle crumbs in it, and I didn't want to put those in the garden. Is there I don't know enough about it. Is there something that's inexpensive that you know, for a way to gather that rainwater and get it, you know, salvaged for the garden without and also filter that crud out?
You know, I'm just wondering if you're just using, and I've done some checking, and I haven't seen any concerns about toxicity, but you may want to, if you're concerned, use it on your ornamentals instead of your edibles,
I
haven't seen any problem with it. You may want to do some kind of filter, and I bet if you went to a plumbing supply place, there would be a way to filter it out to get those crumblings out, so whether it's as you're pouring it into your, you know, even just a fine sieve, you know, might be good enough to get those shingle crumblings out as you're, and I don't know if you pour your water in or have a spigot where you might want either the filter on the inside, but I bet a plumbing supply place or even just a sieve, if you're pouring it into your watering can, would just get that particulate matter out for you.
And thank you very much for calling, Jill. Appreciate it. And Dick in Lake Villa up next. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last year, they treated our channel to kill the weeds. And about a week after they treated it, the flood came up and went into my strawberry bed.
Oh, no.
And it's been flooded a dozen times, but that's the only time that last year my strawberries just were gone completely. And would that kill the strawberries?
If they treated, they were treating... Like your drainage ditch, or is that what you mean?
No, this is a channel and a channel lake.
Oh, they were treating in the water.
Lakes. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
They put granulars and scattered them all over the channel.
Well, if they're putting down an herbicide and it washes into your property, I'm not sure what weed killer they use, but they are plant killers, basically. I'm sure it could have had an impact. What you may want to do is contact... I don't know who did the application, but find out what product they were using, and then that would be a good way to determine. I mean, if it flooded right away and that's in the water, you know.
Yeah.
Well, they said they had signs up this year. They did it again, and they put tags out, and on the tags somebody says, oh, well, it says you're not supposed to use the water for 30 days.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, there's the answer.
But why they didn't want you to use the water was, you know, should you go swimming or what...
Well, and I'm one, and two, with a lot of pesticides, there's a time between application and use. And so
right.
I'm sure they're looking at that in terms of whether you dip into the river and put it on your garden, because if they've applied a weed killer, it would be in that, you know, it would be transferable that way. So it might be worth contacting if they have a phone number and just finding out what they're using, explain your situation, and see if there's some way you can kind of, you know, other than moving your strawberry patch further away where it might be a little bit higher and away from that problem if they're doing this yearly.
Yeah. Thanks, Dick, for calling, and good luck. Stephen Appleton emailed us as a beginning gardener. Last year he bought vegetable plants, but this year he wanted to start from seeds, bought a kit that had the expanding peat pots with the dome and tray, bought a variety of seeds, tomatoes, watermelons, so forth, kept the trays in a warm room. He was excited when in 6 days they started to sprout, took the lid off. After about a week, they wilted, and 2 weeks they were all dead. He says, when I looked closer, it looked like they all had white fuzz, which I'm expecting was some sort of mold. Maybe I had too much water. Last week I planted some more seeds. What advice do you have for me?
You know, the humidity is a good thing for getting the seeds to sprout, but as soon as they pop up, we need to put them in a nice sunny window, better yet, under artificial lights, so that we get good sunlight. Keep them moist and not too wet. So you're right, it's that moisture-humidity issue, and it's always one of those tricky things. The pea pellets are great. I also like using a well-drained potting mix, a sterile well-drained potting mix, or seed starter. Those also work as well. But I find the biggest problem is not the sprouting, but keeping them growing in a good sunny window, because we just typically, you know, you look at April, we had a lot of gray days.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're depending on natural sunlight for your seedlings, you bring stuff inside, it's a tenth the light intensity as outside, and then, you know, gray day in Wisconsin, you're not getting anything. So try to get them as much sunlight as you can as soon as they sprout. And you're right, pop that lid off so you don't overdo the humidity.
And an email from Ken, who says, I'm thinking of growing some tobacco plants in my garden. Any tips for this beautiful plant? I've heard they're very pretty when flowering and offering a nice look for the landscape as well. And I've tried ornamental tobacco, and The flowers really smelled wonderful.
Well, and I don't know if it's different than the flowering tobacco, if we're all talking about the same thing. That's a common bedding plant, which is a tobacco that has, you're right, great fragrant flowers. The butterflies and hummingbirds love it. It does tend to seed around the flowering or ornamental tobacco, but I find that a nice benefit. If I don't want them, I weed them out. They don't come true from seed, so if you get a short variety, you may get some shorter the next year and some taller. They're fragrant in the evening. Full sun to light shade, they'll do fine. Give them plenty of room. Potato beetles, they're relatives of tomatoes. Potatoes are in the Solanaceae family. Potato beetles can be a problem. Just hand-pick them. If you're near a farmer's field, you may see more problem, but I find just hand-pick them, throw them in soapy water. But otherwise, I find very easy to grow and very fun plants.
Yeah, they are. Cheryl in Black River Falls, we go to you now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. What can we do for you?
I'm trying to grow garlic from seed.
Okay.
And what I'm wondering is, last year we grew the garlic and we let it go to seed on us. So we collected these seeds, and now I'm wondering when they grow. I know this was to just become an individual bulb, but do I harvest them when I harvest the rest of my garlic, or do I transplant them to grow into bulbs next year? Because they're only going to be a single clove.
Right, exactly. And you're a hardcore gardener willing to try and experiment, so that's great. You're right. You're not going to get a full-size big bulb this first year. So what I would do is plant them in a protected spot. Garlic is always challenging, so it sounds like you've got the good touch because our seasons are short. Do you plant your garlic in the fall, overwinter it, and get it, or do you put it out early in the spring?
I plant it in the fall, and then I put a big layer of leaves on it this year. And this spring, we didn't have to take the leaves off anything that popped right through. But I also had these seeds, and I didn't know how to plant them. So we planted an area, and they're growing now. And, well, plus the ones in the house start sprouting in the middle of February.
Right.
So I put them in trays, and they're growing, and I put them in the ground. But I'm not sure what to do in the fall. My husband and I are debating.
Well, okay, and you may want to do half and half.
But I would say, he says we transplant them.
Yeah. What you may want to do is because you can put them much closer together this first year, lift them, replant them in a permanent spot if need be, or thin them out at least so they have more room to set those bulbs. So you may need to do a little bit of both. So depending on how close you seed them, you might want to plant them closer, so you're using less room, and then as you're digging them, then you could spread them out and plant them in the fall. But you should be able to leave them in place if you give them enough space.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, well, they really don't have enough space. Should we cut the tops off when we transplant them?
Mm-mm. I'd leave the tops intact because the more energy, the better more energy going into the bulb, and they'll die back naturally when the cold weather hits.
There you got it.
And good luck, and let us know, and it sounds like you may be dividing up the planting, leaving some and transplanting, and let me know who wins.
Okay. Thanks, Cheryl. Philip in Eau Claire, hello to you.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good.
I've got a question about mounding ants in our lawn.
Oh.
I've got these small reddish-brown ants that create mounds. I've tried four different types of granular and powdered lawn insecticide specifically designed for ants, and they just laugh at it. I'm at wit's end. Do you have a recommendation for an insecticide that will work on these ants?
There's two things that are pretty commonly available, really about the most available products for ants. One is permethrin, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. The other is a borax-based product. They found that borax is good at taking care of ants or reducing the problem. And I've seen it sold commercially. So when you look at the active ingredient on the ant killer, those are usually the two things you find. I know, and Larry helped me out, I think Phil recommends digging holes.
You want to take a rod and run it right down the hole as far down as you can and then put the material inside. The problem is you just don't get the material down to the queen. they had ants.
So I'm wasting my money on these overspray things like And
what
happened? I did try borax directly onto the mound,
right?
But I got a lot of grass kill off that too.
And that's why you want to put it down, because boron is in the lawn. Boron is chemical plants use, and as Larry's mentioning, and why Phil's saying, pound it down in there as you're getting the product down. The other thing that happens is a lot of these pesticides are tied up in the soil surface and the organic matter too. So that's why they're not getting down there. So by punching that hole in there and putting the product in there, one, if you're using the borax, you're going to be below the grass roots.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you won't damage the grass roots. And if you're using the permethrin, you're going to get it down into that, into the nest. So try that. I think you'll find you'll have much better luck.
And good luck. Thanks for calling, Phil. Joy in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Joy.
Hi, thanks. I have a question about what's growing in our wastewater treatment system. We have a constructed wetland in a liner on the top of our mound kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we planted plants in there that were purposely to, like wetland plants, to use our wastewater.
Okay.
Well, a few years back, I think someone mistakenly identified what is the name of that? Something reed grass.
Canary reed grass.
I think it was just a sedge grass that we planted there. Anyway, my husband was supposed to paint herbicide on that. So what I think happened in the meantime is an opportunistic plant came in and took up some space, which is stinging nettles.
Mm.
So it looks to me, I don't really know how that grows, but it seems like if I pull it up, there's a big rope of roots underneath.
Mm-hmm.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to take that out without,
chemicals?
A couple of things, I personally try to use minimal chemicals. I do honestly use Finale and Roundup when I'm tackling certain plants. If you don't want to use those, one of the things you can do is just continually cutting the plant at ground level. And if you keep after it and prevent the leaves from forming, then you eventually starve the plant to death. There's also some more eco-friendly products that burn the tops off, but they don't kill the root system, and they use soaps or plant oils. And you can almost get the same effect by continually cutting off the top of the plant. So you're right, digging is a problem because there's a couple trains of thought now about digging out weeds. As you pull them up and you bring a lot of weed seeds with it, so then you're introducing more weeds and you're not always getting the whole rhizome. So my option would be if you continually dig and get all the rhizome, you'll eventually get after it, or continually cut the top, or again, doing that technique where you're painting on the Roundup or Finale on the plant so it's being absorbed and going into the rhizome, that root system.
That'll do the job.
Right, and minimize the use of your chemical.
Melinda, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Get out and enjoy this beautiful afternoon.
I will try to do that. And go to Melinda's website, melindamyers.com. Melindamyers.com. Take a look at her books and get signed up for her podcasts. And you're going to find a lot of great information right there from Melinda. And she'll be back. We'll do this again. And thank you for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.